the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and a day of celebration in Utah. Wow, happy Pioneer Day, and also the Winter Olympics coming back to Utah in 2034. Exciting times. Also exciting are our guests this hour on The Mountain Life. First, guest co-host Katie Mullally and I speak with best-selling author of The Emerald Mile, Kevin Fedarko. He joins us this morning to talk about what he calls his misadventure, a 750-mile hike through the Grand Canyon. He tells all in his new book called A Walk in the Park. Then, Mary Beth Maziarz and I speak with author and journalist Michael Castleman. He discusses the untold story of books. It's a writer's history of book publishing from Gutenberg to Amazon. Our guest, Michael Castleman, knows his books. Very interesting conversations. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. You're listening to The Mountain Life on KPCW Park City. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Now, when we think of an adventure in the Grand Canyon, we normally think of the several hundred miles down the Colorado River in a raft, or maybe about the rim-to-rim hike, until you hear of what our next guest did. You likely wouldn't know that a 750-mile hike would even be possible in the Grand Canyon. Well, nor did he, our next guest, Kevin Fedarko, who miraculously completed the hike with friend and National Geographic photographer Pete McBride. Kevin lives to write a book about this misadventure. It's called A Walk in the Park. Kevin Fedarko has spent the last 20 years writing about conservation exploration and the relative mesmerization he feels about the Grand Canyon. He's the best-selling author of the book, The Emerald Mile, the epic story of the fastest ride in history through the heart of the Grand Canyon. His writing has appeared in National Geographic, the New York Times, Esquire, among other publications. And we're so pleased that he joins us today. Kevin Fedarko, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
We have friends, many of us in our lives, who present wild ideas about things that, you know, we probably should never attempt. And those friends, somehow we carry throughout our whole lives. And so too have you with Pete McBride. How did it come about with Pete asking you to attempt this?
Well, I mean, as you say, we all have people, many of us have people like this in our lives. I would say that, you know, my relationship with Pete, my friendship and my personal collaboration with him is particularly dysfunctional because, you know, partly because it goes back so many years. We've spent the better part of the last 20 years working together on magazine assignments that have taken us to some fairly exotic parts of the world, places like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, the Horn of Africa, the Caucasus Mountains, Everest Base Camp. And all of those assignments, all those experiences, they have at least two things in common. First of all, they were events in which things went terribly wrong. Disasters befell us that got us way in over our heads. And all of that was Pete's fault in each and every instance, mainly because it was he who first conceived the idea of these assignments. And although we were both at fault, I like to blame him for the lack of preparation and the totally inadequate homework that characterized our approach to these assignments. So this is kind of a tradition, a theme in our relationship, but it culminated in this misadventure that we had starting in the fall of 2015, involving a rather harebrained idea he brought to me, in which he suggested and actually told me that, you know, we were going to put on 55-pound backpacks and walk from one end of Grand Canyon National Park to the other, despite the fact that there's no trail between those points.
And what could go wrong, right?
What could possibly go wrong? Exactly.
Well, 53 pounds, I think, was his, and yours was 55 pounds when you start. But you didn't end with that kind of weight. And luckily, you had this group of real hikers that helped you out in the beginning, and it's kind of amazing. I mean, I'm assuming you threw around that name National Geographic, and that's why they stuck around to help you and to help you shed those pounds. And then, speaking of shedding pounds, you know, your bodies, there are photos in the book of holding your skin out where there used to be something that filled it. Talk a little bit about this group of people who were real through hikers.
Well, I mean, one of the few things that Pete actually did right in the midst of all the things that he and I did wrong is he reached out and managed to convince a group of incredibly experienced long-distance backpackers who were embarking on their own continuous thru-hike of Grand Canyon to permit us to tag along with them for what would be the first section of our journey. And here, maybe I should just mention very briefly, there are two ways to do a thru-hike in the Grand Canyon. One is a continuous thru-hike where you begin, you enter the canyon, you don't come out until you reach the end. And the other, which is what we were planning, is to break it up into sections. And you come out of the canyon at the end of each of those sections to rest, to reprovision, maybe to wait out a season like the summer season before you go back in, pretty much at exactly the same point that you left. And you string those expeditions together like beads on a necklace. So, you know, one of Pete's great gifts is the art of seduction. This is how he's talked me into all of these terrible ventures in the first place. And he practiced those on this group of thru-hikers. And despite their awareness that it was probably not going to be a good idea to allow a couple of neophytes to be tossed into the salad at the last moment, they said yes. And they said yes mainly for a reason that you just alluded to. This was an assignment for National Geographic. And National Geographic wanted us to do this story because this was the fall of 2015. And the National Park Service was getting ready to celebrate its 100th anniversary. The centenary of the founding of the National Park Service would take place in 2016. And National Geographic thought that a really great way of commemorating and acknowledging that landmark event would be to have two journalists, a writer and a photographer, move through Grand Canyon on foot, move through, you know, what is it's the second most visited national park in the entire national park system. The only park that gets more visitors than Grand Canyon is Great Smokies back east, which also has a highway running through the middle of it. And it's the second most visited, but it's unquestionably the single most iconic park in the entire system. And so the idea was, let's have these two journalists move through the interior and conduct an informal inventory of the secrets and treasures that are hidden inside of this space that are not readily visible to the majority of the people who just come to the edge and look in. And in the process of doing that, let's also have these two journalists examine some of the threats that loom over this landscape in the park. Threats in the form of, you know, tourist developments or industrial projects that have the potential to irreparably harm the integrity of the landscape. And I'm spending some time on this because these are the reasons why these people agreed to help us. They understood that if we could move through and tell the story of the landscape, there might be a way in which that would help to protect Grand Canyon, or at least raise awareness and publicize some of these threats and make Americans understand that although so many of us think of our national parks as places that are sacrosanct and inviolable, they're in desperate need of protection. They are under constant threat, and they require each and every generation of Americans to renew the commitment that was made back in 1916 with the advent of the National Park Service in the first place, to renew the commitment to protect these spaces and pass them along intact to our children and our children's children. So that's why they allowed us to come along, and that's why they must have been horrified when they realized that we were so incompetent and so poorly outfitted and so ill-prepared that not only were we not able to complete the first section of our hike, we had to abandon that section less than half the distance From the beginning of the hike to the end of the first section. We crawled out of the canyon, we retreated back to Flagstaff with our tails between our legs, confronting the fact that we had failed and facing the prospect of making a phone call to our editors at National Geographic headquarters in Washington, D.C., and just explaining that, look, if you guys want this project completed, you're going to have to outsource it to like a couple of kibab squirrels or a pair that's more capable and competent than us. So that was how this whole thing started. It's how it began. It was an incredibly inauspicious start to what would prove to be an epic misadventure that would last for more than a year.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we are having a conversation with Kevin Fidarko. He is the author of the new book, A Walk in the Park, the true story of a spectacular misadventure in the Grand Canyon. Well, Kevin, The Emerald Mile is required reading in my family. It was my father's favorite book and still one of mine. So this wasn't a through hike like we think about with like Appalachian Trail or Pacific Crest Trail, because those are actually trails. So much of what you did was basically bushwhacking along the rim or down by the river of the Grand Canyon. What was it like to go that distance without a trail?
Incredibly unpleasant, in a word. And also really, really long. Maybe that's a good place to start. I'm sure that many of your listeners are familiar with the Grand Canyon, and many of them may know that, you know, there is a highway through the Grand Canyon. It's a really good throughway. It's called the Colorado River. It's the instrument that carved and created and polished and sculpted the canyon in the first place. And in the course of making its way from Lee's Ferry in the east to the Grand Wash Cliffs, which form the western terminus of Grand Canyon, the Colorado River covers a distance of 277 miles. But if you are on foot trying to make your way through that landscape feature, unlike the river, you will be forced to move into and out of innumerable tributary canyons that pierce the main stem canyon on either side, some of which are really enormous, many of which take hours, if not days, to make your way into and back out of. And by the time you've returned to the mouth of one, you know, a particular tributary canyon, you'll discover that you've managed to move about 100 yards downstream. And as you're doing that, you're also moving up and down the walls of the canyon, because the system of ledges and terraces that you use to move laterally along the canyon are continuously giving way. And at those points, you need to begin climbing or descending to find a new system of ledges. And so you combine all that together, the detours into and out of the tributaries, the movement up and down the canyon walls, and a journey that the river makes in 277 miles balloons into a walk in excess of 750 miles. And that's also one reason why there's no trail. I mean, this is probably the most broken and shattered and fragmented landscape feature that we have on the face of the North American continent. It seems almost designed by nature to resist and impede and thwart the prospect of human beings moving through it on foot. It's illogical. It doesn't make sense. That's why the first recorded traverse we have of Grand Canyon in recorded history, in modern history, that's an important distinction, was made in the summer of 1869 by John Wesley Powell, the one-armed Civil War major who led an expedition consisting of 10 men, including himself, in four wooden boats, entirely by river through Grand Canyon. And it wasn't until 1977 that somebody figured out for the first time in the modern era, a river guide by the name of Kenton Grua, how to move through the thing on foot. So that gap, I'm terrible at math. What is that, like 106, 107 years? That speaks to the impossibility, the difficulty, the illogic, and the stupidity of moving through this landscape by any means other than a boat.
Well, in the book, you talk about how John Wesley Powell came across what were, you know, fragments and remnants and even, you know, current proof that there was still people living within the canyon. And you devote a large part of the book, or a significant part of the book, to the history of Native tribes and their relationship to the canyon. How did that understanding their history change your relationship with the Grand Canyon?
In every way imaginable. And partly that's because of my own ignorance and arrogance. You mentioned a moment ago, I mean, you bestowed some very kind words on this book that I wrote prior to A Walk in the Park, The Emerald Mile, which is it's a chronicle of three boatmen who put a little wooden dory into the Colorado at Lee's Ferry on the crest of a giant historic flood in the spring of 1983, and used that flood as a hydraulic slingshot to propel them through the canyon faster than anybody else had ever done. It's an adventure story. It's also it's kind of like a giant 430-page love letter from me to the hidden world of wooden boats and whitewater at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. But it focuses on adventure. It focuses on the culture of the river. And it spends very little time acknowledging or offering thoughts about one of the most salient and important and problematic facts about this landscape. And that is that, you know, I spoke a few minutes ago about what like an iconic national park this is, right? Everybody knows it. Everybody recognizes it, even if they've never been there. It's incredibly famous. And yet so few of us, including me, are aware that before we took this canyon and made it into a national park, it was home to Native American tribes, people whose connection to and understanding of and relationship with the land, the canyon itself, runs deeper than anybody who looks or sounds like me can even begin to imagine. People who lived inside of and considered this place their home for thousands of years prior to the arrival of white Europeans. And this isn't just one tribe. There's 11 Native American tribes whose ancestral lands abut or lie directly inside of Grand Canyon National, what's now Grand Canyon National Park. And when we made this park, when we created the park, we pushed those people out. We exiled them from their homes. We forcibly removed them physically from the landscape. And then we did something that was just as bad. I don't know, maybe it's even worse in some ways. We wrote them out of the story that we tell ourselves about what this park and all of our parks amount to. The story we tell about our national parks is a self-congratulatory myth. It's a story that has some really, really wonderful components to it. You know, the story is basically that, you know, at some point in our history, we recognized the value and of natural beauty. And we took some of our most gorgeous features and we put fences around them in order to protect and preserve them and pass them along intact to our children and our children's children. The myth part of it, the lie, is the part that we neglect to say, which is that we basically stole this stuff from people to whom it belonged, who were here before our forebears arrived. And so I wrote this entire book about the river world of the Grand Canyon without really acknowledging any of that. And this new book, this new journey, which was not a river journey, it was moving from the world of the, away from the world of the Colorado River, into the world that begins, you know, like 20 yards off your left and your right oarlock at the edges of the river, and it soars more than a vertical mile into the sky through these ramparts of cliffs and ledges that comprise the walls of the canyon. This is not a world of water. This is a world of rock. And as we made our way through this landscape, we had a series of encounters with members of tribes who are Native and Indigenous to the canyon, and who, by the way, were part of the canyon's past, were physically removed from and exiled from the landscape, but are still there. I mean, they're still living around the canyon. They're still incredibly connected to the canyon. They're still linked by culture and language and tradition. They've not allowed those connections to be severed. They have nurtured and sustained and kept those links alive. And they therefore inform and are part of the canyon's present, as much as they were of the past. And by virtue of having survived and sustained themselves, they're also a part of its future. And so a huge part of this book, to answer your question, I'm sorry, I'm being incredibly long-winded here, but I feel that like this is a really important element of the story in this park and this landscape. A huge part of this journey was doing something that I was too ignorant to do in the previous book, which was to focus the landscape through the lens of the history of its tribes. And I think that that is an indelibly important part of this story. And I've made a huge effort to lay that out, to acknowledge it, and in a way, to try and honor these tribes.
Yeah. We're speaking with best-selling author Kevin Fidarko about his new book, A Walk in the Park.
Well, it also, as you're talking and as I was reading your book, thinking about how we all have these very contradictory emotions and perspectives. And, you know, you mentioned that if you're in a raft, rafting down the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon, unless you're, you know, your raft guide points out certain things and you really embrace the hiking aspect of it, you might not look the 10 or 20 yards off the river to consider those native peoples, the history, the fact that they have been hiking and walking these non-trails, as you call them, for millennia, really. And so I'm wondering, as you were hiking along these non-trails, trying to make your way and pick your way, to what extent did you get that feeling of the past and the history? And, you know, any time that any of us who live here in Utah or visit Utah and we go to these areas, these little known corners, and we come across a trace of history, it really ties you more to the land. And so I'm wondering if you could comment on some specifics that you mentioned in your book.
Yeah, I think maybe the place to begin is just to say that these artifacts, these remnants of the past, are incredibly powerful. And yes, you're right. I mean, when you hike through the canyon, it's not as if you encounter artifacts every single step of the way, but you do begin with time to develop the ability to see things that you otherwise might have missed. And the more acute your eye becomes, the more you begin to see. You see potsherds all over the place from the vessels that the ancient peoples of the canyon shaped from the earth itself. You see arrowheads and spear points from the tools that they used to hunt animals to enable them to survive. You see niches in the canyon walls called granaries, where they stored and sealed off their corn and their seeds in order to protect them. And, you know, at very special places that are quite rare, you will see affixed on the sides of the walls of the canyon, you will see art that these people created, art in the form of what we call petroglyphs, which are images that are pecked into the surface of the stone physically, or polychrome pictographs, which are essentially paintings on the rock. And all of these things, but the art in particular, has an immense power to it because it contains the ability to bend time. It has the ability to enable you to, once you've stepped into the presence of a fragment of the past like this, you are hurled backwards through the centuries, hundreds of years, and then in the case of some of the polychrome petroglyphs, thousands of years, even perhaps as many as 10,000 years, back right up to the back end of the Pleistocene itself, when the earliest nomadic hunters and gatherers, people we call the Archaics, people about whom we know almost nothing because they left so little behind, when they were moving through a landscape that was very different in terms of its climate, in terms of the plants and the animals that flourished there and upon which they survived. And this is all part of the canyon that is sometimes neglected a little bit, because what do we do when we think about, when we talk about, when we share ideas about, when we try and describe to others the Grand Canyon? Well, we talk about how exciting it is to raft the canyon and what a thrilling adventure that is. We talk about the rock itself. We think of the park as a geology park, as a living open textbook of rock with 26 different layers of stone, all of them stacked on top of one another chronologically, so that each successive layer, as it rises from the river toward the sky, is younger than the layer beneath it. And we talk about the fact that because of that geology and because of the way the rock is stacked, the canyon itself is a kind of a time machine. It's a time machine, and the clock starts when you step onto the rim of the canyon and you stand on the Kaibab limestone and you realize that you're standing upon rock that was created approximately 226 million years ago. Think about how long that is for a moment.
Yeah.
That's 180 million years before the giant asteroid that struck the Yucatan Peninsula, that wiped out the dinosaurs, that cleared the biological decks for the evolution of mammals, that would then enable primates to climb down from the trees on the savannas of Africa and evolve into human beings. That's 180 million years before that asteroid struck the Earth. And that's where the clock starts in Grand Canyon. And each step that you take below the rim through successive layers of older and older stone hurl you further and further back into the past until you get to the bottom of the canyon. You're surrounded by this world that's created by the Vishnu Schist and the Zoroaster granite, which is 1.9 billion years old. That's a third the lifespan of the planet, and one-tenth the age of the universe itself. So we think about all this geology, and we celebrate geology, and we celebrate deep time when we think about Grand Canyon. But when you bring Native Americans and their relationship with the canyon into that picture, you find yourself acknowledging two things. One is that the human history is dwarfed by the geologic history. We've only been there, we've been there for less than 10,000 years. It's barely recorded. It's not recorded in the rock itself. It's only recorded in the artifacts, the bits and pieces of things that we have left behind. But you also realize that even though that time segment is much thinner, those people have penetrated deeper into and connected with the landscape on a level that none of us have. And so you can perhaps begin to glimpse, as I talk about the artifacts and the relationship to the time, how what the Native American story does is it adds another layer of richness and complexity. It's as if you added a whole nother layer of rock on top of all the other ones, another page of history. And why would you ever want to read a book when a hugely important page has been ripped out of it? So that's what the Native American element brings to the picture in terms of the artifacts that you were just asking about, in my view.
Well, Kevin, one more thing before we let you go. I know that another big part of the story, which is what we started with, is your relationship with Pete McBride. Will you do us the honor of reading the very last caption of the photos in the book? I think it really sums up the journey that you two took together and how you two are actually still friends.
Okay, here we go. And you'll have to pardon me, it's been a while since I read this. The western border of the park is so remote that the only thing demarcating it are three metal fence posts driven into the sagebrush. Reaching this milestone represented the completion of an odyssey that had taken more than a year to finish. After passing through that boundary, however, Pete and I came to understand that the rewards of our effort lay not in the act of completion, but in the gifts that had already been handed to us along the way, the wonders we had witnessed, the hardships we'd endured, and the bond of friendship that was sealed by both.
That's perfect. I think that really does sum up the fact that this was a journey along the rim of the canyon and along within each of you.
So nice. The book is A Walk in the Park, the true story of a spectacular misadventure in the Grand Canyon. Our guest is Kevin Fedarko. Kevin, how often do you pick up a backpack and go backpacking?
Oddly enough, given how unpleasant the journey was with Pete, not as often as I would like. I didn't think when I was right when I was when we were doing this hike, I didn't think there could be anything less pleasant and more painful than the walk itself. But the writing of the book, the hike took a year. The writing of the book took 7, and it was incredibly difficult and arduous. And among other things, it imposed a whole set of sacrifices on me. It took time away from my family, and it took time away from the places I love, including the Grand Canyon. And I haven't been able to go there as often as I would wish. And one of the things that I most look forward to as the book makes its way into the world, and as I'm able to return to the life that I had before the book, I'm looking forward to going to the closet and pulling out the backpack and all the other gear and walking again, maybe not the whole length of the canyon, but going back in, maybe even with Pete, to some of the most special places that we visited during that magical year that we spent inside the canyon.
I'd love to be a fly on the canyon wall and listen to the conversation between the two of you, both back when you did the hike and again. I can only imagine, like brothers.
There was a lot of very immature humor and inappropriate commentary going on. So maybe it's a good idea not to be a fly on the wall.
Exactly. All right, Kevin Fedarko, thank you so much for joining us today on The Mountain Life. It's been a pleasure and an honor.
Thank you so much. It's been the pleasure is all mine. Really appreciate it.
And we will be back after this. You're listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
This morning, we bring you a story full of surprises about books. Why did books become favored Christmas presents? Why is New York the nation's publishing capital? And many other interesting mysteries about books. Our next guest, Michael Castleman, knows something about books. In fact, a lot about books and about writing. Michael is a journalist and novelist and author of more than 2,000 newspaper, magazine, and web articles, 14 consumer health books, and 4 mystery novels. And he joins us today to talk us through a book, his new book, in fact, The Untold Story of Books, A Writer's History of Book Publishing from Gutenberg to Amazon. He joins us now. Michael Castleman, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having me on. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I imagine that for a person who has been through the process a lot of times of trying to get a book published, it's really important to know the untold story.
Well, I think so. I started researching this book 44 years ago in 1979 when I signed my first book contract. And I thought, you know, if I'm going to be in this business, maybe I should learn something about it. And I'm glad I've been studying it, because over the decades of researching this book, it's clear that a lot of what people believe about books and book publishing is sort of mythological. You know, the idea that authors become rich and famous, for example. Well, that is true for about one author in about 10,000. I mean, the New York Times publishes, the New York Times bestseller list contains 200 books a year out of 2 million published every year now. And digital publishing since the year 2000, digital publishing, ebooks, and the digital publishing of print books too, everything is digital now. We have so many books published that each book kind of disappears. It becomes a snowflake in Antarctica, a blade of grass on a golf course. And so it's easier to get books published today than ever before, but harder than ever to get them noticed and to promote them and to sell them.
Well, the fact that you're coming on the Mountain Life show is a very good indicator of the success of your book, Michael.
Well, thank you. Yes, it is possible to get some attention for books, but it's harder than ever. Mm-hmm. And this confounds legions of authors. The Authors Guild, which is the leading organization of authors in the country, has a community forum by, you know, on its website. And before 2000, a lot of the questions were, how do I get published? Since 2000, it's usually, how do I get this noticed? How do I get it promoted? No one seems to care. I put 2 years into this book and I've sold 50 copies. I mean, right now, the sad fact is that self-published books, 80% of self-published books sell fewer than 100 copies, than 100 copies. On the other hand, the flip side of that is if you publish a book and it sells 100 copies, you're in the top 20% of sales.
Oh my gosh, that's a wild number. It's kind of reminds me of podcasts, right? They say that like if you have more than 30 subscribers, you're in the top 1% of podcasters.
Right. Yes. You know, when podcasts came in, they were, you know, everyone, oh, check out this podcast. Well, now in the United States alone, there are more than 3 million podcasts. That's a lot of podcasting, and the same thing is happening in podcasts or music that's happening in the world of books. There's just so many items out there to choose from that sales per new book have plummeted, and the pie is cut thinner than a dust jacket now.
It's so true. I actually, in my other life, I'm a musician and I put out a number of CDs and, back in the day, you could really make an impact, but these days it's a lot harder. And my kids' friends, I ask them what they're listening to, and they say, oh, I listen to people you've never heard of. And I'm like, oh, well, great. You could put me in that category now because there are so many millions of artists out there putting out really yeah. good music, you know, but it's harder to penetrate. Well, tell us about your journey of figuring out that you wanted to write about books as well as writing books themselves.
Like I said, I started out in 1979 just researching the industry, seeing what I could learn about it. And I had no thought of writing a book about it until almost 30 years later, until 2005. At that point, I started thinking, you know, I've got so many files on this, and the digital revolution is having such an impact that it just slowly dawned on me, hey, there's a book here. And particularly as we were transitioning, around the millennium, we transitioned from what's known as industrial publishing on high-speed industrial offset presses to digital publishing, which is either ebooks or a souped-up computerized offset printing that's even faster than ever. And this transition was confounding everyone, myself included. And I thought, you know, I've got all this information. There's something here. And so that's when I started writing it in 2005. I spent 18 years on and off writing this book in between and among a whole lot of magazine articles and two or three other books. But I was always chipping away at this, trying to make sense of the publishing industry, which has very mythologized. You know, people think, for example, people think that the publishing industry is genteel, that it's a nice industry, as opposed to other more gritty industries. Actually, publishing is as gritty as any industry. It is intensely competitive. Companies are driving other companies into bankruptcy every day. And if you ever want to participate in a ongoing brawl, be a publisher.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with author and journalist Michael Castleman. He's talking to us today about his new book. It's The Untold Story of Books. It's a writer's history of book publishing. Michael, kudos to you, because I really don't know anyone who has researched a topic for four decades and then taken many, many years to write the book. It must be perfect.
Well, I'm industrious and I believe in persevering. The famous quarterback Joe Montana of my own San Francisco 49ers was once asked, how did you get so good? And his answer was, you know, I showed up at practice. And that's what it's about. It's about sticking with it and persevering. And that's what I've done in my career. And that's what I did with this book. And I did not write this book alone. I had three professional editors went through it at a substantial expense on my part. And then I had 50 other readers who were writers and editors and people in publishing. So this book was really my name's on it, but it takes a village. And this book was really written by a village. And that is one of the problems with self-published books, is that they are not well edited. You know, it no longer really matters anymore who publishes a book. It matters how the book reads. And anyone who's an author or an aspiring author, they think, oh, you know, I'm going to sit in a little room by myself, write this book, and then my incredible genius will be recognized by everyone. Actually, get your book edited, because you're going to need it. No writer can turn out perfect work alone. Every writer needs editors, and I've had a lot of them in my life, and the most ever for The Untold Story of Books. So that would be my advice to anyone out in your listening audience who's contemplating writing a book or self-publishing through Amazon or whatever. Before you do that, hire a couple of editors to make sure your book reads well, make sure it's coherent, because readers are sophisticated, and then they expect good reads, and that's what we've got to give them.
Yeah, those sophisticated readers are editors, you know, in and of themselves, right? Whenever they're reading your book. I wanted to ask you, and this is a little bit selfish. We have had The Mountain Life on air for, gosh, I think about 13 years now. And we've gotten very picky about, other than local authors who want to come and talk about their books, we've gotten picky about the publishers. You know, we want very well-reputed publishers, you know, Simon and Schuster and Penguin Random House. And I have this belief, and I'm wondering if you will confirm or otherwise, that to a large degree, these really reputable publishing houses, they're doing a lot of the vetting. Therefore, I trust, especially if it's something that's, you know, that has to have facts. I know that to a certain degree, this, the publishing house has vetted this. They've vetted the author. They've, you know, re-edited the edited work. They have done their work, and therefore you can trust it. True or false?
Mostly true. Yes, the major publishing companies and independent presses. I mean, Untold Story of Books was published by an independent press in Los Angeles, Unnamed Press. But publishers who are for real include editing in their operation. And there's three kinds of editing. There's developmental editing, which is the big picture. Does this flow? Are the characters good in fiction? Is the argument good in nonfiction? And then comes line editing. Line editing gets very little press, but it's critical. Line editing streamlines the flow. Line editors work with the sentences and the paragraphs. So developmental editors work with the big picture. Line editors work with sentences and paragraphs to streamline them, make sure they make sense and are a good read. And then the third level is copy editing, which is, you know, fact-checking, grammar, usage, and then beyond that is proofreading. So there are four levels of tinkering that go on, and established publishing companies employ all of them, and good independent presses do too, and some pay-to-publish outfits, what are now known as hybrid publishers, where authors pay a publishing company to publish their book. A lot of hybrid outfits also have the four levels of editing, but a lot of self-published stuff, ebooks on Amazon, just don't. And when you read them, it shows. I mean, I read a self-published book that read like it was tossed off in a weekend by someone who had never heard of the word dictionary. And that just turns off readers, and that's not what writers want.
Yeah. I've done the same thing. You can almost tell within the first few pages if it's hasn't been copy edited or checked right. over closely. And it starts, you start to drift away from the book. It's distracting. Yeah. What were some of the things you found most interesting about just the evolution of the books and publishing industry?
Well, one of the insights that I drew from this whole experience that you'd never heard before is that the myth is that publishing never changes, that it's hidebound, that, you know, is, you know, unlike other industries, publishing is somehow, you know, chiseled in stone and doesn't change. Actually, that's totally false. The publishing industry is the total product of the evolution of printing. And as printing changed, publishing changed. And the arc of this change is that with every advance in printing, fewer people could produce more copies of more books faster and cheaper per copy. And so as more books started coming out and they got cheaper, books evolved from being a luxury item for the rich, which is what they were before the Civil War. Books cost today's equivalent of $600 a piece. But after the Civil War, as print speeds increased, there were more books, a lot more titles, a lot cheaper, and the prices fell. So that by 1900 or so, a hardcover book cost today's equivalent of only about $75. And then after World War II, ongoing innovation in printing drove the price of books down to $25 for a hardback, which is about where they are now. But with digital publishing, one lone person can publish an infinite number of ebooks in about an hour for about $100 and distribute them worldwide for free. There's been an explosion of titles. And those titles cost less and less. I mean, a lot of ebooks cost less than a dollar. So this is one of the things about publishing that people don't understand, that it's always changing. It's a kaleidoscope. And publishers who don't keep up, there's a word for them, bankrupt.
Absolutely. My husband is a photographer, and he used to do a lot of editorial work for magazines, and he told me a few years ago about Magazine Death Watch, this organization that was keeping track of these really long time heritage magazines that were starting to not be able to make it anymore in the current economy. Do you think that readers these days have the attention spans to really jump into books? We're always hearing about how they're getting shorter and shorter.
Yes, readers keep reading. One of the myths about books is that other communication media threaten them and are going to destroy them. Every time a new communications medium has been introduced, self-appointed guardians of culture start moaning about how it's going to kill books. That happened in the 1880s when Edison invented the phonograph. A lot of literati said, oh my God, it's going to kill books. No one's going to read anymore. Libraries are going to turn into record collections. It didn't happen. When radio and movies were introduced, radio and movies were both introduced before World War I and swept the nation. I mean, people loved radio and movies. And guess what? People were predicting, oh, they're going to kill books. They never did. The same thing happened with television. When I was a kid, television was just being introduced. And people were saying, oh, television is going to kill books. It never did. And the same thing has happened with digital media, websites, the internet, TikTok, you name it. Everybody's predicting the death of books. Books don't die. Reading is resilient. Not everybody reads for pleasure, but millions of Americans do. And they love to read, and they're not going to stop. And Americans today buy 800 million books a year, and libraries lend out another half a billion. So Americans are reading more than a billion books a year. To me, that is not a moribund industry. That is an industry that is resilient, and books have maintained their cultural position despite all new media. You know, you always have to be very careful about predicting the future. The future is unpredictable, but I'm predicting, and I'm very confident, that books and reading will survive.
Hallelujah. Well, we talked about a couple of the questions and mentioned those in the intro that you provide answers to. It's kind of the fun part of your book. Things like, why did books become favored Christmas presents? I just thought it was because a lot of times I can't think of what else to get.
Right. Well, as a gift. Yes. And that's why bookstores are open on Christmas Eve. Books became Christmas presents in the 1820s, because when Christmas evolved, you know, Christmas didn't used to be, originally Christmas wasn't Santa Claus and presents for kids. Originally Christmas was drunken rousings by the community. In the 1820s, the drunken revelry of Christmas started threatening the upper crust in the major towns. There was, you know, acts of vandalism in New York City on Christmas. There were gangs roving the street, beating people up. And so people who were cultured started thinking, let's change Christmas to a sort of domestic indoor holiday with, you know, this gentle Saint Nicholas, and he's going to give presents. Well, what presents should he give? Giving Christmas presents was a long tradition, but it was almost always things like, you know, homemade pies and jam and that sort of thing, consumables. And just as this was all happening, just as press speeds were speeding up and it was cheaper to publish books, and you could publish illustrated books more efficiently. And so publishers started bringing out lavishly illustrated books for kids around Christmas time, and they became favored Christmas presents. And Christmas is still the single biggest, you know, November and December are the two biggest months for book sales, because books are traditional and popular Christmas presents. But it all started out with illustrated children's books because printing allowed it before the Civil War.
Well, stories like these, along with a great history of books from Gutenberg to Amazon, our guest is Michael Castleman, and his book is The Untold Story of Books, A Writer's History of Book Publishing. What a fun book, Michael. Thank you so much for that 40 plus years of research.
Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
It's a really fun book. If you're a book lover, you should dive into this and really enjoy it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.